On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Incorporating Bioavailability Considerations into the Evaluation of Contaminated Sediment Sites. Today's training was developed by the ITRC Contaminated Sediments Bioavailability Team. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to serve as a moderator. I'm going to cover some introductory material in the next few slides and then quickly turn the presentation over to our trainers from the ITRC Contaminated Sediments Bioavailability Team. As listed on slide one, today's training is based on the ITRC Technical and Regulatory Guidance, Incorporating Bioavailability Considerations into the Evaluation of Contaminated Sediment Sites. Today's training is an introduction to this document, and we do encourage you to review the guidance itself. And at the end of the training, we'll take you to a link where you can access this web-based guidance. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, CLUIN. Moving to slide two, if you're new to CLUIN, it's a series of orange buttons along the top that allow you to navigate. Each of you in the audience are in control of what slide you're on, and the slide number is listed in the upper left-hand corner. The trainers will say the slide number throughout today's presentation. Today's course is scheduled for 2.25 hours. We're going to have question and answer breaks, one in the middle and another at the end of the training. For our phone line audience, we'll remind you at that point how to unmute your phone so that you can ask questions out loud. For the simulcast audience, that orange question mark at the top of the slides allows you to type in a question. And anyone is welcome to use that at any time during today's presentation to send in a question or a comment. As we move through the slides, each of you is in control of what slide you're on. On our last slide, we have a link to our feedback form. We do ask that everyone on the call today take just a few minutes to fill out the feedback. We do use that information and appreciate you taking the time. Today's class is being recorded, and we offer archives of previous ITRC training classes. On slide three, the notes section of this slide includes the ITRC disclaimer. In short, our disclaimer says that we've tried to provide accurate and reliable information, but do not warranty this material. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. ITRC does not endorse any specific products. ITRC's presentations and documents are copyrighted. You can also access the ITRC disclaimer and copyright information on the ITRC website. And on slide four at the top, we do list the website for you. ITRC is hosted by the Environmental Council of States. Overall, ITRC is a network that's led by state regulators. We include federal partners, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry, academia, and community stakeholders. This diverse group works together, and we address a wide variety of topics that may be specific to a type of contaminant or a type of technology. And we communicate our results through our products, our technical and regulatory guidance, and our training classes. On slide five, you can see examples of topics that ITRC has recently addressed. These are topics that we're offering training in 2013. We offer internet-based training, and we offer courses from previous years. We continue to offer the popular courses, and we develop new courses each year. We also offer a two-day classroom training on LNAPLS, and that is coming up in June in Springfield, Illinois, and in October in Garden Grove, California. For the 2013 schedule, you can visit the ITRC website to find more information. On slide six, I'll introduce our trainers. All trainers were members of the ITRC Contaminated Sediments Bioavailability Team. The team was led by John Cargill of the Delaware Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control. John is our first trainer today. He's a hydrologist with the Delaware Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control located in Newcastle, Delaware. He oversees contamination assessment and cleanup projects conducted by responsible parties and developers in the state, and also designs and implements state-led assessment and remediation projects, including contaminated sediments projects. Steve Clow is a senior environmental toxicologist at Haley and Aldrich in Manchester, New Hampshire. Since 1988, Steve has performed ecological risk assessments under CERCLA RCRA, which require detailed exposure assessments that incorporate bioavailability factors and in-depth knowledge of parameters that affect them. Diana Marquez was scheduled to be our next trainer, but she is unavailable, and a special thanks to Tamara Sorrell for filling in. Tamara is a senior risk assessor and life sciences group manager in the Somerset, New Jersey, and Westford, Massachusetts offices of AMEC. She's a toxicologist with specialization in both human health and ecological risk assessment. She's applied a variety of assessment tools, including food chain modeling, in-situ pore water measurements, hydrocarbon fingerprinting, macrobenthic surveys, bioassays, and equilibrium partitioning. Greg Newman is a research scientist in the Bureau of Environmental Evaluation and Risk Assessment at the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection in Trenton. His primary responsibilities are the review of baseline ecological evaluations and ecological risk assessments associated with both state and federal Superfund sites, as well as the review of remedial investigations and remedial actions for soils at the most complex sites in New Jersey. On slide 7, I'll now turn today's presentation over to John Cargill of the Delaware Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control. John?
Thanks, Juliana. Can you hear me okay?
I can, thank you.
Okay, great. I want to make sure I'm not muted. I want to welcome everybody to today's training on the ITRC Contaminated Sediments Team document, again titled Incorporating Bioavailability Considerations into the Evaluation of Contaminated Sediment Sites. A mouthful to say the least. Our team, which we initially formed in 2007 and then kicked off in 2008, is comprised of just an incredible mix of state, federal, and private entities, as well as academic and community interests. Now, from just a quick glance at this slide that's on the screen, it should be evident that we have this great mix of professionals that really look at contaminant issues from differing points of view and, for different client interests as well. We utilize this mix to really evaluate how and to what degree bioavailability is being addressed at contaminated sediment sites across the country, and also to understand the usefulness and the problems associated with incorporating bioavailability into exposure assessments and risk management decisions that come out of those. So if you move to slide 8, contrary to most of the ITRC documents that you all might be familiar with, this document is web-based, which means that you don't get a nice bound copy for your bookshelf like previous ITRC documents. Instead, we've chosen to use technology to our advantage. You should be able to navigate very easily from chapter to chapter and section to section within this document. Now, if you prefer to have a paper document, we do have the option to print a PDF version. I think it's up in the upper right-hand corner of the website. The real benefits of this web-based document are the maneuverability around the site to the topics that interest you most, and also our ability to link you directly to some of the more important supporting documents that are referenced throughout the guidance. And this saves you time and energy in locating them yourself. Now, I anticipate that you'll see more and more ITRC documents adopt a web-based format in the future. We appreciate any feedback that you might give us on how to make future documents even more user-friendly. Again, this is one of the first ones we've done on the web. So back on topic, this particular slide really shows just a basic outline of what's covered in the document. Our web-based guidance describes the mechanisms affecting contaminant bioavailability, the tools that are available to assess bioavailability within the most common exposure pathways, the proper application of those tools, and also how bioavailability information might be incorporated into risk management decisions. This guidance also contains a lot of case studies that illustrate the application of the tools that we'll talk about and how the information that we gathered was utilized. Because of the complexity of some of the material that we'll discuss in the document, the team does assume that the user has a reasonable understanding of risk assessment processes, a reasonable understanding of contaminated sediments in general, and an appreciation for the value of using bioavailability assessment information. And lastly, a basic knowledge of human health and ecological risk assessment terminology, methods, and approaches. Therefore, we do recommend that at a minimum, the user familiarize themselves with the EPA EREGS, which is the Environmental Risk Assessment Guidance, before reading our document. However, as a backup, as I mentioned before, we've included an abundance of web links throughout the document to direct you to additional information and additional detail about the topics that we cover. If you move to slide 9, please. The intent of our presentation today is to give you a brief glimpse of what the web-based bioavailability and contaminated sediments document has to offer. We hope you'll find that it's a good tool or reference when you're faced with investigating a contaminated sediment site, and also give you some insight into the available technologies that are there to help you better assess and understand the risk posed by contaminants and sediments. In short, today we're going to hit on, one, the concept of bioavailability. We're going to hit on what bioavailability means when looking at contaminated sediments specifically. We'll go over when you should apply bioavailability adjustments to assess risk. So we'll go over some of the tools that are available for use to assess bioavailability within, you know, the most common exposure pathways, as I mentioned, and also how the information gathered can be incorporated into your risk management decisions. What we will not teach today is how to conduct a risk assessment that incorporates bioavailability, but instead highlight the tools and techniques that are available to assess bioavailability that can then be used within your risk assessment. So as I previously mentioned, the level of detail in this document, for the most part, is a result of the assumption that the users have a working knowledge of sediment sites, a basic level of understanding when it comes to risk assessment. We intentionally focus on bioavailability concepts and have omitted information that pertains directly to the conducting eco and human health risk assessments. So if you move to slide 10, we want to talk about the problem. Now, with EPA reporting that approximately 10% of the U.S. sediments pose a potential ecological or human health risk, the associated conventional cleanup costs, mainly dredging, to remove this stuff could be in the trillions of dollars. Now, by recognizing that contaminant concentrations in sediment have an indirect relationship with actual exposure to those same contaminants, there's a huge, huge opportunity to use available science, specifically bioavailability concepts, to reevaluate the levels of cleanup required to be protective of the same receptors. With today's economic climate, better characterization of contaminant exposure to receptors is increasingly important, so unnecessary cleanup costs aren't incurred, or so that more sites can be cleaned up potentially with fewer monetary resources. So there's definitely a problem that needs to be solved. If you can move to slide 11, please. We want to talk about what bioavailability is very briefly. And we're going to answer that question, especially as it relates to this particular document. Now, according to the National Research Council, bioavailability is defined by the individual physical, chemical, and biological interactions that determine the exposure of plants and animals to chemicals associated with soils and sediment. Now, more specifically, bioavailability addresses the fact that only a fraction of the contaminant concentration present in the environment might be taken up by a receptor or result in an effect on an organism. Now, our document is focused on the definition I just stated, how to communicate and assess this concept, and how to benefit from its use while still remaining protective of human health and the environment, which is obviously of utmost importance. Please move to slide 12. How can bioavailability make a difference? Now, I've already mentioned this, but again, if contaminants aren't physically accessible or chemically or biologically available, then they really shouldn't be included in the calculation of risk. This is particularly important for sediment sites where, you know, two of the primary remedial options, being capping and dredging, can significantly alter those physical, chemical, and biological conditions, and really disrupt the existing habitats. So if contaminants are determined to be, you know, quote-unquote, unavailable for uptake, you know, with the use of the tools we're going to introduce in the training today, you know, this unhealthy disruption of an ecosystem might very well be minimized or even avoided altogether, and add a substantial cost savings to states and PRPs. So put another way, really, bioavailability can be an important factor in balancing the risks that are caused by remedial action with the risks that are actually being addressed by the remedial action. Let's go to slide 13, please. Now, in order to focus the scope of this document, as well as document how bioavailability is currently being used in the industry, we prepared a case study questionnaire and distributed it to members of our ITRC contaminated sediments team, to other federal agencies, state agencies, and to industry professionals. The goal was to establish how bioavailability was used at a site and determine if its use contributed to the risk management decisions at the site, for instance, by maybe helping to establish a cleanup goal. The results of the questionnaire were used to categorize the case studies by the primary pathway where bioavailability was assessed, and also the tools that were used during the assessment. We collected a total of 35 case studies. Much of the information obtained from our survey is captured in Table 9-1 and in Appendix D of the document. Appendix D gives a little more detail and maybe some contact information if you prefer to get some more information. The table summarizes that in shorter form. Now, in that table also, we list exposure pathways that were addressed, the contaminants of concern at the site, as well as the bioavailability tools that were used to assess risk at the site. So maybe if you're comparing a site that you have to something that we have information on, you can look at similar size of site, maybe similar contaminants of site, and utilize that to help you along as well. Now, as I mentioned, additional information can be obtained by using contact information and web links that we provide in that Appendix D. Now, so if you can go to slide 14, please. I'll talk about some of the results of the questionnaire. Now, we determined through our review of these case studies that the most common exposure pathways evaluated were the benthic exposure pathway, the human health exposure pathway, and then the pelagic exposure pathway, essentially water column. Now, bulk chemistry was the most common tool used to assess bioavailability, followed by tissue sampling of various media, fish, bivalves, other water column receptors, and then pore water chemistry, either by direct sampling of the pore water, maybe by solid phase microextraction or some sort of passive sampling method, and prediction using equilibrium partitioning theory, so a mathematical assessment of what's bioavailable, as well as then bioassays. Now, of the case studies where bioavailability was actually used, only about half assessed one pathway, and that was the benthic pathway. But in every case study we reviewed, more than one tool was used to assess each pathway that was studied. And this multiple line of evidence approach is something that I want you all to remember, and we're going to come back to later on in this presentation. So please move to slide 15. So contrary to the web-based document online, and this is an attempt to keep all of you interested, I'm going to spend a little bit of time now talking about the usefulness of what we're presenting today in making risk management decisions. And when I'm finished, we'll dive into how this information can be collected within each pathway. Now, when I say it's contrary to the web-based document, this section is at the end of the document as opposed to at the beginning. So I'm just kind of flip-flopping it here. Now, risk management, as the slide says, integrates the results of risk assessment with technical, political, legal, social, and economic objectives. Now, the U.S. EPA, in the 2005 Contaminated Sediment Remediation Guidance for Hazardous Waste Sites, they recognized the need to improve the scientific foundation for contaminated sediment remedy selection by improving site and risk characterization, by understanding how different remedial options can effectively reduce risk to humans and the environment, and to optimize the cost effectiveness of remedial actions. Now, remember that bioavailability addresses the fact that only a fraction of the contaminant concentration present in the environment might be taken up by a receptor or result in an effect on that organism. So understanding and characterizing bioavailability, utilizing the tools described in this document, can really increase your understanding of the cause of toxicity and the potential long-term effects to the receptors. Now, it can also help identify the most effective remedy to target critical exposure pathways, and also lay the foundation for the most appropriate monitoring requirements at your site. So in other words, assessing bioavailability can really be a great tool in managing the overall risk posed by your site contaminants. In the document, we refer to three areas where bioavailability data can be used to help make risk management decisions. Those areas are in your risk assessment, during remedy selection, and during your remedial design and implementation phases. So if you could turn to slide 16, please. Now, risk assessment, as used here, does not necessarily refer to traditional human health or ecological risk assessment per se, but to the cumulative assessment of risk to all the receptors identified at a site, the long-term risks, and evaluation of stakeholder interests. Now, an investigator or regulator should strive to gain the best possible understanding of the physical, chemical, and biological processes that really drive the aquatic risk at their site. In other words, the means of your contaminant transfer, uptake, and concentrations at which adverse effects to receptors occur. Bioavailability information could be used as a tool to augment traditional site characterization and human and ecological risk assessments to actively inform and refine your CSM, your conceptual site model, for contaminated sediment site. Now, we recommend that you get your hands on another ITRC document called the Use of Risk Assessment in Management of Contaminated Sites. I believe this is referred to as ITRC Risk-2. Now, this document details the usage of risk assessment information to aid in risk management. And again, you know, it'll just help you get through some of the complexities of the document that we're providing information on, and really help you identify where these bioavailability considerations can really be stuck into the risk assessment itself. Now, some folks, maybe responsible parties, uninformed regulators, they might see the collection of this bioavailability data as extravagant, probably unnecessary, and definitely, in some cases, costly. But good communication with your stakeholders can really help to justify the fact that additional costs incurred during the assessment phase might actually result in a reduction in the overall risk at your site and or the cost of remediation, for that matter. The critical factor is to ensure that the collection of the additional bioavailability data can be directly translated into a reduction of risk and then subsequently remedial costs. So on this slide, we've listed a few critical considerations that should be taken in the process of assessing overall risk at a site where bioavailability is concerned. And I'm not going to take the time right now to read all of those. You guys can take that home with you and take a look at it. If you move to slide 17, I want to talk about risk assessment and bioavailability. Now, where bioavailability and overall risk are concerned, we've identified a few advantages and challenges maybe for your consideration. Some of the advantages are if contaminants aren't bioavailable, then they aren't included in the evaluation of risk. We've mentioned that a couple of times. Optimization of your cleanup goals is an advantage of using bioavailability with this possible cost reduction. And what I mean by that, I guess, in a sense, is that you really only clean up areas that are causing the impacts to the receptors. You're not cleaning up the whole site based on one number. You figure out what's causing toxicity and you clean up those areas. You have a more effective use of available resources. You know, you only spend your money on the things that give you good information. And maybe an example of that would be collecting core water chemistry data as opposed to more bulk chemistry data because it tells you something specific which can be translated into risk. And lastly, you can achieve more accurate and defensible cleanup goals while at the same time ensuring protection to the receptors. Now, some of the challenges that you might face are uncertain acceptance by regulators, stakeholders, and the public. It's a relatively new concept. You're not taking all of the contamination out of the environment, so sometimes that can make folks nervous. So you'll have that challenge to overcome. Bioavailability may also vary across the site or maybe operational units of your site. So you can't just collect data in one area and say it's going to be the same for the other area. It could be vastly different based on you know, physical and chemical as well as biological parameters. Now, you also have a potentially higher site characterization cost, as I've mentioned here. Collecting this data up front is a little more expensive than your traditional assessment might cost. But again, if you can be open with your stakeholders and your regulators for that matter, you know, you can overcome that by really targeting what you're going to collect and making sure you utilize it in a good way. And lastly, you know, it might take a lot longer, or maybe not a lot, but it might take longer to gain a full understanding of your site conditions. So let's face it, these sediment sites are complex. The information you gather might cause you to have to go back out and gather a little bit more that you didn't think you needed in the first place. So it may take a little bit longer to get a full understanding, but once you have that understanding, you can really tailor then remedial actions to the actual conditions out of sight. So if you move to slide 18, please, I'll hit on bioavailability within remedy selection. Now, the results of a site-specific risk assessment, if we've mentioning here, which bioavailability can be a major component of, can be used to evaluate the appropriate remedy for your site. The use of bioavailability within this process, can lead to a more realistic evaluation of the contaminant effects to the exposed populations through a reduction in uncertainty about the site characterization process. Therefore, really, bioavailability can be used to make a more informed decision as to whether further action is required at a site, and if so, really help form the basis for evaluating the extent of sediment requiring further action. Now, ideally, you'll select a remedy that will reduce or eliminate exposure of your receptors to contaminants of concern both during and after remedy implementation. Now, at a site we're going to talk about later called Mox Pond, contaminants were identified by bulk sediment chemistry that were further evaluated using some in-situ pore water measurements, surface water measurements, tissue testing, and solubility testing. Now, remember earlier when I mentioned that using multiple lines of evidence to assess the risk is important? This is a really good example of that. At this site, although the bulk sediment testing identified elevated concentrations of heavy metals in the sediment, the bioavailability testing that was done showed that site contaminants were really tightly sequestered and not biologically available to water column organisms. And as you'll learn later, the remedy was designed around some of these ideas and concepts. It was a really good case study to look through. If you go to slide 19, please. Now, remedial design and implementation, it can be exceptionally challenging when you're dealing with a contaminated sediment site where potentially contamination has been spread across property boundaries and in some cases through entire watersheds. Assessing bioavailability, it will not only help you understand what chemicals are available for uptake by the receptors, and again, I add, with the potential to cause adverse effects, but also to characterize toxicity in order to effectively design or implement a remedy to mitigate those negative effects. Now, by incorporating bioavailability considerations into the early stages of site characterization, through the risk assessment process and right up through the point of remedy selection, a more effective remedial design can be accomplished, which, I think can really and very likely lead to a reduction in overall cost of the project. Now, since the objective of a remedial design is to remove or reduce a contaminant concentration or the exposure pathway of concern, bioavailability measurement tools can also be useful in monitoring the effectiveness of your remedy. For example, pore water monitoring within or above a cap, a sand cap, might indicate whether groundwater discharge or upwelling is mobilizing contaminants into or through a clean cap, or potentially whether bioturbation is mixing clean sediments with the underlying contaminated sediment to agree that receptors are being exposed at harmful levels again. If you move to slide 20, and this is the last slide that I'll go over before I actually turn it over and you start learning about the tools that are available to assess these things, I want to point out that there are definitely limitations and uncertainty around the use of bioavailability to manage risk, and it's important that you know what some of those are and how you can minimize those, and a few of them are highlighted here on this slide. Now, first, there's already uncertainty in data assessment methods and models, and knowing what those uncertainties or assumptions are is very important, so you can work to reduce them through proper and targeted collection of additional data. Now, since the dynamics of most aquatic systems are subject to change, associated changes in physical, chemical, and biological properties that affect bioavailability, it really should be expected. Development of a good conceptual site model and monitoring controls are really critical to an effective sediment assessment and remedial action. This is something that must be considered when making risk management decisions. Now, in addition, we would expect that land use changes might take place over time at a sediment site, Now make sure that this consideration is discussed early in your investigation process with stakeholders and other interested parties to ensure that risk management decisions are made appropriately for the long term. And lastly, state regulation and policy actually might preclude you from using certain tools or methods discussed in this document, and it's important that you find out this information early. We can't tailor our guidance document to one particular state or one particular jurisdiction, so there might be a few roadblocks that you might have along the way. So find out what those are early and try to avoid those. So really, the take-home message here is to collect data that answers a good question about your site, so you can really know your site, and good communication with your regulators and stakeholders is absolutely essential. Now, I hope that I've given you all just enough information on how to use bioavailability information that you want to continue to listen to our training today. And I'd like to turn it over to Steve Clow, who can really give you some of the nuts and bolts of this bioavailability stuff. He's a toxicologist and risk assessor with Haley and Aldrich. Now, Steve specializes in assessing impacts to benthic communities in estuaries, rivers, and streams. He's going to introduce you, as I said, to areas where bioavailability can be assessed and the many tools that are available to do that. So, Steve, please take it away.
Thank you, John. Good morning, everyone. I'd like to start out with a caveat, and that is that we've gotten questions before about can bioavailability be applied to areas where you have fairly high energy environments. And so everything we're talking about today is dealing in areas that are sedimentary in nature. It may sound obvious, but you really want to be dealing in an area where you've got sediment collected, and it's probably not going to be moved by scour. Certain sites, like on the Hudson River, there are maps out there that will tell you whether you're in a depositional area or a scour zone or whether there's debris or something like that. So that's just an immediate caveat. On a more personal note, I joined ITRC, this committee, about one-third into the process, probably back in the summer of 2010, and I was really kind of blown away by the amount of information that they had already accumulated, just a fantastic bibliography. And Juliana and John have talked to you about going to the website and surfing it, and I guarantee when you get there, you'll catch a big wave and have a very long ride. It's a very information-packed document. I still type in bioavailability considerations into Google when I need to get a document that I'm looking for that I can't put my fingers on. So I encourage you all to go and visit the website and surf it. Now, if your boss or staff manager were to come up to you and say they wanted to double your salary, you'd be pretty thrilled with that, right? And that's only a factor of two. And if they said, well, I'm going to increase your salary by 10 times, that's a factor of 10. As risk assessors, we always deal with factors of 10 or 100 or 1,000. Well, with bioavailability, a factor of 2 can cut your risk in half, and maybe a factor of 3 or 4, even 10, can save your client. As a site I'm working on up here in Wellesley, where we had 2,700 parts per million of lead was our highest concentration, and we went through bioassays, and to make a long story short, everything lived because the type of contaminant there, which was lead chromate, is totally insoluble. So basically, with one test, we saved the client over $2 million in cleanup costs. So it's really important, as John said, to consider bioavailability at the outset and as you move your way into the site. Now, slide number 21 is a graphic of the document itself. Chapter 2 is scoping and development of a conceptual site model. Chapter 3, we go into COPEC, which is constituents of potential concern, COPEC selection, which is, of course, one of your first steps in a risk assessment. And Chapter 4 addresses your receptors. Five chapters addresses your receptors. Chapter 4 is benthic invertebrates. That addresses mainly benthic invertebrates that are in the sediment, that may be bioturbating it in a freshwater environment that's like the 0 to 6 inch layer, and in a marine environment that's about a 0 to 2 foot upper layer. Chapter 5 is fish and aquatic invertebrates, which is mainly your pelagic species in the water column. Chapter 6 is your wildlife receptors, such as muskrats, minks, ducks, herons, which would be in a wetland environment. And mainly they're exposed through inadvertent ingestion of sediment. Chapter 7 addresses bioavailability to plants, and Chapter 8 addresses bioavailability to humans. And notice through all these chapters, we have weaved into each chapter bioavailability concepts, the tools, which I'm going to talk about today, the models, and the applications. And once you have all that information, it's fed into your risk assessment. Hopefully you've gleaned some type of bioaccumulation factor or bioavailability factor. And then that's fed into, is your risk acceptable? If it's not, you move on to Chapter 9, which is your risk management considerations, and then if it is, there's no further action. So we'll move on to slide number 22, and this is scoping your site. Now, I tell people that I work with, you really need to sort of fall in love with your site. You need to know it like the back of your hand, and this includes starting off with a site history. You have to do your due diligence. You need to go over the manufacturing processes that went on there, the chemical inventory, what type of disposal practices they had, and then, of course, maps and historical aerial photographs. And so you really need to know what's going on. A lot of that's laid out in your phase one and phase twos before you even get into your risk assessment. The next bullet is site boundaries, the extent of nature and extent of contamination. Remember that sediments know no boundaries. If it's not an isolated wetland, your sediments will move downstream to your next-door neighbor downstream, and then your upstream neighbor, whatever contaminants that facility has, will move onto your site. So you need to, a good example of this would be like a pulp and paper mill where dioxins and furans could move down for miles on end. The next step would be in scoping would be your knowing your contaminants of potential concern or COPEX. A good example would be manufactured gas plant sites where you have PAHs, but you also have inorganics like cyanide, and a lot of people will just measure total cyanide. Well, they're not aware that laboratories will analyze also for physiologically available cyanide or PAC. And so it's important that for a compound like that you have both total and physiological, because physiological is going to be the bioavailable fraction of cyanide. And finally, onto the conceptual site model, which a lot of people really kind of gloss over. And I think it's the cornerstone of your risk assessment and in determining where bioavailability fits in. So you need to have a source, and these can be graphical or a flowchart, but you need to have your source, the exposure pathways, the receptors and exposure routes, such as dermal or ingestion, and then what's going on in space and time and fate and transport. So most state regulators will require that you have a conceptual site model up front. They're a lot of states are very strict about this. Moving on to slide number 23, these are some of the processes to consider during scoping. We have the team is divided up into physical, chemical, and biological. And obviously, each one of these bullets you could spend an entire semester or a thesis on, so I can't get into too much into depth here. To give you an example of a physical process, the Copper's Barge Canal in South Carolina. It was a coal tar site, and this site had a huge population of fiddler crabs. And basically, we'd go out there and we'd do a piece of a plank out on the sediments, and when you jump up and down, you could actually see the water upwell through all these holes that they made. And that site basically got a monitored natural recovery assigned to it because the fiddler crabs were mixing this sediment up so well that a lot of these stringers and the coal tar that was there was being either diluted or metabolized, and so year after year we could show that the levels of pH has went down. Chemical processes are good. As most of you know, sediments are anoxic. Let's say you had a company that was discharging hexavalent chromium into the water. Well, the sediments are anoxic. They will reduce that chromium to chrome 3, which is has a very low bioavailability to organisms. So that's an example of a chemical process. And then biological, as I just said, most sediments are anoxic. The reason they're anoxic is because of microbial activity that's going on in the sediment, and you can get biotransformation of organics. And a good example might be that fish don't bioaccumulate PAHs, and then fish and shellfish might have high levels of arsenic. As a matter of fact, most fish that you find in a grocery store have elevated levels of arsenic. But that arsenic is in a form of arsenobutane, which is a natural occurring protein. And most people don't realize that, well, I've got high arsenic in my fish, but they don't realize that they don't need to worry because that arsenic is in not only a non-bioavailable form or a low bioavailable form, but is not toxic. That's a particular form of arsenic. Moving on to slide number 24. This is an example of a conceptual site model. As I said, they can be either graphical or they can be a flow chart moving from left to right on the paper. And the conceptual site model, as I told you, and as John told you, considers the source, the migration pathway or the media of concern, the receptors or receptors of interest, the time frame and the space and state and transport over space. And this example here of the Anacostia River shows you just about everything under the sun as far as processes that are going on. Most conceptual site models are not this busy, but this is a good example that shows you most of the physical, chemical, and biological processes that you might see at a site. Moving on to slide number 25 is chapter 3, which is screening your site. Now, there are sediment quality values out there that are not site-specific, and such as threshold effect concentrations like TECs or probable effect concentrations like PECs. There's hundreds of sediment quality values out there. Remember that these are not site-specific, and you should not use them as cleanup goals or cleanup criteria. Now, some states, like the state of New York, they actually have them posted as if they would be cleanup criteria, and you have to be careful with this because, you know, you could do a toxicity test and show that there is no problem, even though you're vastly exceeding a sediment quality value. Now, these sediment quality values are conservative values, and the lower ones are levels below which there is a good probability there is a low risk. And the upper ones, the ceiling values, are values above screening levels that do not imply an acceptable level of risk. There's a higher probability that there'd be an adverse effect. But as I told you at the site I worked on in Wellesley, we had thousands of parts per million of lead, and there was no toxicity. So we were 10 times over the PEC value for lead, and yet we saw no toxicity. So you need to be careful. So in screening your site, you can use these values to determine if there's a need for further investigation. Again, do not use them as cleanup levels or PRGs. And if you are going to use them, beware. Know how these screening levels were derived, because a lot of them are from, say, Canada or Europe, or if they're derived in the United States, some of them may be archaic. They're very old, such as the AETs, something like that. So that's it on screening the site. It's just to determine if there is a need for further investigation. And usually most screening quality values will not pass the test. This slide, number 26, screening and bioavailability. Normalization is when you divide the bulk sediment concentration by, say, a percent organic carbon, or if you have a metal, such as arsenic tends to gravitate towards iron. Cadmium and zinc are typically related to each other. You can measure another non-site related metal and normalize the metal concentration to aluminum or iron, something like that. So normalization of bulk sediments can be applied within the screening process under some state regulatory programs. And there are also sediment quality values that express it as percent of TOC, such as milligrams of benzoate pyrene or micrograms of benzoate pyrene per gram of organic carbon. And those values are out in there in the literature, and they're fairly solid numbers based on equilibrium partitioning. However, it's important that you assess site impacts using bioavailability in the later stages of the site investigation. And this graphic down here below is just a conceptual graphic of what bioavailability means to the organism. If you look at the letter D, that is really where the contaminant will cross the biological membrane. So A, B, and C could be, the D could be the gill of a fish, and A, B, and C could be the surface water outside that gill. And once absorbed into the only bioavailable species will be absorbed into the organism and maybe go to the site of response like a liver or a kidney. Or A, B, and C could be inside the intestine of a mammal, and D could be the gut wall. So this is just to show you conceptually what bioavailability is as a heuristic tool. On to slide number 27, I believe. Yeah, slide 27. Again, this is reiterating what the document looks like. Chapters 4 through 9 are the meat of it for the tools. And if you go on to slide number 28, you'll see that primarily for the remainder of this webinar, we're going to be discussing benthic invertebrates, risk to benthic invertebrates, and humans, because they are the key receptors at sites, and they will drive most of the risk. So on to slide number 29. The team basically divided benthic invertebrates up into three genres. Chemical testing, sediment, pore water, groundwater, surface water, biological testing, bioassays in vitro in the lab, and then predictive methods, which include equilibrium partitioning modeling, narcosis or the target lipid model, SEM-AVS, which is a way of evaluating the bioavailability of divalent metals, copper, cadmium, lead, nickel, and zinc, and then the biotic ligand model, which is related to metals also. On to slide number 30. One of the most common ways we determine an impact to a sediment is with a sediment quality triad. John talked earlier about the multiple lines of evidence. You can't really get away with just one test. You have to show that there are multiple lines of evidence for low bioavailability. So a sediment quality triad is essentially you take a sediment grab, a fairly large sediment grab, maybe 8 liters or so. You'll composite that or mix it up, and you'll take a sample for chemistry and get your bulk sediment and pore water concentrations or pore water concentrations. And remember that bulk sediment is a very poor predictor of bioavailability and often toxicity. And then you'll send maybe a couple liters of that sample off to a taxonomy lab where they will sift the sample, get macroinvertebrates out, and measure abundance, diversity, your benthic indices, and possibly body burdens in some instances, although I don't recommend that because macroinvertebrates are such, they have a lot of contamination on them rather than in them. And then the remainder of the sample you'll send off to the bioassay lab where you will do toxicity bioassays mainly on the solid phase. And you can also do bioaccumulation testing using worms that will directly, aquatic worms that will directly ingest the sediment. So on to slide number 31. sediment. I want to address the chemical part of bioavailability first. And with divalent metals, what is typically used, and EPA has a lot of guidance on this, is simultaneously extracted metals, or SEM, and acid volatile sulfide. So basically you take a sample, like a 100-gram sample from your location, and then send it to the lab. They will add acid to it, and you know metals will dissolve in acid, so the metals will be extracted off, and that's called the simultaneously extracted metals. And the acid volatile sulfide will volatilize off, and they will capture that and measure both. And the reason we do this is because divalent metals have a charge of plus 2, whereas acid volatile sulfide has a charge of minus 2. So when these are in equal proportion, they're typically bound up. And when the metals exceed the sulfide, you start to see metals come out in pool water, and you'll start to see toxicity. And in the upper right-hand graph, you'll see that. This is a sample from, I believe, Long Island Sound and other areas in New York, where they're measuring sediment cadmium, and as the ratio of cadmium to acid volatile sulfide approaches 1 or is below 1, you see very low mortality. But when the ratio starts to increase, you start to see toxicity because all of the acid volatile sulfide has been bound up, and you see additional cadmium in the pool water. Now, this model is developed by EPA, Don Vittoro, and a bunch of other bright scientists back in the 70s and 80s. And they further refined this model. This is in the metals, US EPA metals mixtures guidance. And they further refined this by subtracting ABS from SEM and then dividing by FOC, because they realized that organic carbon has a strong metal binding component. Now, with this model, they were able, in the upper model, they were only able to say with confidence when there was no toxicity. In this model, they found out that if you were above 3,000 micromoles per gram organic carbon, that you could always predict toxicity, and if you were below 130 micromoles per gram organic carbon, you could always predict there would be no toxicity. And in between those two, it was fairly uncertain. The EPA number is in the lower left-hand corner. I would urge you to go to this guidance and read it, because it is quickly gaining acceptance within many state and federal agencies for use for assessing the bioavailability of divalent metals. Again, that's cadmium, copper, nickel, zinc, and lead. Silver is sometimes included, but silver has a very low bioavailability wherever you have just any reasonable levels of organic carbon. On to slide number 32. These are some of the tools we'll discuss to assess the benthic pathway chemistry-wise. Centrifugation is the most common way, centrifuging the sediments away from the pool water and taking the supernatant. Syringes or suction devices, pedometers are often used, or even a well point driven into a shallow sediment. UltraSeep and Trident probe we'll discuss a little bit. Solid phase microextraction, and then some of the indirect methods, sediment peepers, sediment permeable membrane devices, sometimes called fat bags. These are dialysis membranes. Diffusion and thin films is for evaluating metals bioavailability directly in sediment. And then SPMEs or POMs, polyoxymethylene films, or just polyethylene strips that you might find on a 3 or 4 mil trash bag will actually absorb hydrophobic compounds. The Gore-Tex module, and then diffusive flux we're going to talk about. And then slide number 33 is an example of using, this is a suction device. This was Farm Pond in Framingham, Massachusetts. It had high levels of VOCs moving in from the shoreline, and we called MassDEP, and you know, obviously you can't do a bioassay with a volatile compound because it'll volatilize away and reduce your exposure or dose. We called them and we asked if we could measure pool water and then compare VOCs to national recommended ambient water quality criteria. They said that was fine. So the photograph on the left is a moon pool on a zodiac. And the clear Lexan tube is an air column that was introduced from the boat down to the sediment. You basically put a cap on it, and like your finger on a straw, drop it down into the sediment. And through that air column, we introduced a well point, which is the white PVC riser here. And into that well point, we put an air stone. This is sintered glass air stone attached to a polycarbonate tube, which in turn is attached to a silicone tube that goes to a peristaltic pump. And we drop that down into the well point and pump the pore water out. And you can see the photograph over on the right. Even the water within the well point was turbid, but the glass-sintered air stone keeps the sediment out. And we were able to get a nice, clear sample of pore water and send that onto the lab. And it turned out that even though sediment had parts per million levels of VOCs like tetrachloroethylene, 1,2-dichloroethylene, that all of the pore water was negative. So we were able to close that site out. I think we had maybe 15 different stations, and none of them were above the ambient water quality criteria. On to slide number, 34. This is a semi-permeable membrane device, sometimes called fat bags. This is basically a meter-long dialysis tubing, sealed at the end, and you put in just 1 mL of a fish oil, artificial fish oil, which is Triolean. You seal that up, and it's put on this spider device that is being held by this field tech, and it's wrapped around the spider device. So it has a very high surface area to volume ratio. And 3 or 4 of these are put into this corrugated device down below, and then the cap is put on, and that can be put into sediment or surface water, and it's left for 28 days to equilibrate. And basically, you will be able to find out the concentration in the pore water or surface water if you know what the mass flux ratios are for the compounds of concern. And over on the right, you can see one of these pulled out. You can see the biofouling on it. This one was in surface water. And they take the dialysis tube off. They send it to a lab. They clean it up. They reverse dialyze it. And they measure, in this case, it was dioxins and furans. I would recommend these for PAHs. They didn't work terribly well for dioxins and furans, I think mainly because of the diffusion for that, those compounds are low, but they work very well for PAHs. And by the way, this is a proprietary device, and you need to call the lab ahead of time and have the vendor reserve these for you if you're going to use them. On to slide number 35. These are sediment peepers, probably some of the oldest. This is one of the oldest techniques for indirectly measuring bioavailability in pore water. The acrylic device over on the left, you have routed into it these cells, and you lay it on its back, and you fill each of these cells with purified distilled water. And then over that, you lay a dialysis membrane and then another template that is the exact copy of the keeper device itself. You screw that down, and then you drive these vertically into the sediment. You usually leave 1 or 2 of the cells above the sediment-water interface so you can see what's going on. When you pull it out after about 30 days, you'll take a hypodermic needle and pull the water out of each one of these cells and send it to the lab. And slide number 36 is an example of one of these peepers. Over on the left, this is the acrylic body. You can see the cells that were routed into this device. And these are filled with distilled water, and it's placed into the sediment. That wedge down at the bottom helps drive it into the sediment. And the photograph in the middle is another type of peeper, but this is for a coarser environment, like a coarse sand or gravel or cobble that you will drive down in with a hammer. And I also have to warn you have to know exactly where these are when you drive them in, because they're difficult to find And you have to know also what the water levels are, because we always use submerged buoys. But you really have to keep an eye on just exactly where these are deployed. And then over on the right is data. This is data from Industriplex back in the 90s. You can see how arsenic levels vary with depth for the south, the central, or the north placement of these peepers in the Hallsberg holding area pond. So these are very useful. On to slide number 37. We're going to discuss the Trident probe and the UltraSeep. These were developed, I believe, by the Navy. The Trident probe over on the left will measure temperature, conductivity. In the probe in the middle, you can see the little holes that will actually sample pore water at different depths. These were mainly developed to look at the interplay and interface between groundwater and surface water. Because as you know, groundwater will always have a different temperature than the surface water. So using these probes, you can find your footprint fairly easily. Once you find the footprint, you're going to use this UltraSeep device. And you can see it on the right-hand photograph. And this large cylindrical device will be put over the area where you think the water is seeping out at the greatest rate. And it will actually collect pore water as it seeps out or as groundwater migrates out of the sediment. And that device in the back with the red the red probes will measure your conventional parameters such as pH, dissolved oxygen, salinity, conductivity, and things like that. So that is one of the direct methods for measuring pore water in a water body. On to slide number 38. We're looking at both, you can use this both directly or indirectly. These are solid phase microextraction devices. Basically, it's it's almost like a GC in a reverse. Over on the left hand side, this fellow is holding it's a very thin, like a thread or a wire that's coated with polydimethyl siloxane, I believe. And it's a hydrophobic compound that will strongly bind a hydrophobic compound, other hydrophobic compounds. Like binds like. The advantage of this is you can use maybe just 1 or 2 mils of pore water to measure your hydrophobic compounds in a very small amount of volume. This is mainly used for PAHs. It's not really ready for prime time yet. It's more in the research phase for PCBs. Over on the right hand side, you see photographs of one of these in cross section. The upper left hand corner is an ultraviolet microphotograph of one of these in cross-section that is not exposed to PAHs, and in the lower right-hand photograph is a light photograph of a cross-section. In the upper and lower left is a thin-walled and thick-walled version of these steamy devices that have been exposed to PAHs, and PAHs fluoresce so you can see pretty much what's going on here. They bind very nicely. And I one caveat here is I recently looked at a site where I wanted to use these for PCBs, but the lab basically told us that what it will measure mass very nicely, but you're going to have to know your volume. And so if you need to know what's directly in the pore water at the site, it's a fairly involved process, and especially deploying these. And it's really only a qualitative measure, for like the vertical stratification of, say, how many PCBs per inch as you go into, down into depth you'll have. So, you can research these through the web-based document. Again, I encourage you to look, at how this is described in the document. On to slide number 39, these are called Gore-Tex modules or Gore-Zorbers. This is exactly how it sounds. It's Gore-Tex membrane like you would wear on your jacket, your rain jacket, which is a very hydrophobic compound. Again, like binds like. The advantage of these is that they can be deployed. They're relatively inexpensive. You can deploy a whole mess of them. They're not too difficult to deploy. And it will give you a good indication of nature and extent of VOCs. And the disadvantage is it's mainly useful for VOCs and maybe some of the light molecular weight, low molecular weight SVOCs like naphthalene or the methyl naphthalene. And over on the right, you can see how these are put together. And again, these are described in the ITRC bioavailability document. On to slide number 40. Let's see. My computer doesn't seem to be working. Okay, here we go. On to slide number 40. Tools to assess the benthic pathway, and we're getting into the biological here now. And obviously that's solid phase sediment bioassays. The middle photograph shows you a typical setup in a sediment bioassay lab. Each one of these rows of sediments, I think there's maybe five or six here, they take a sample and they homogenize it and they screen it out to take out native organisms and debris. And then they put these as replicates. So you usually have 5 to 8 replicates per sample. And into each one of these jars, you'll add 10 organisms. And the length of bioassay varies with the organism, but it's usually 28 to 30 days. Now over on the left, you have the freshwater organisms that are typically used. You have Hylella azteca, which is a side-swimming freshwater scud. And these organisms are sensitive to metals. They will burrow into the sediment somewhat. They'll also swim around the water column. And then we have Chrononis dilutus. This is a larvae of an insect, freshwater midge. And these are sensitive. Obviously, they'll be sensitive to things like pesticides. I just worked at a site where it was next to a golf course. And instead of doing both of these organisms, we doubled the number of high-level organisms because we knew that the golf course pesticides were not related to the site and would probably do a number on the insects. So you need to be aware of what organism you're going to use and why. And then over on the right, it's organisms for estuarian or marine environments. Neanthes is a burrowing worm, which will actually eat some of the sediments, so these critters are getting a fairly good dose. And then Euhistorius is an organism that is typically used for brackish or estuarian waters. And so if these tests are correctly performed, they're very ecologically meaningful and relevant. And I would also caution you that if you do a bioassay test, that you have plenty of reference sites or reference samples in your reference site, at least 4 or more, because I've seen reports where they only have 1 reference sample, and that does not make a very good statistical test. As a matter of fact, it's pretty much invalid. So on to slide number 41, where we're going to talk about macroinvertebrate surveys out in the wild. These are photographs of macroinvertebrates that you would catch out in nature. EPA's Rapid Bioassessment Protocol document, this is in the web-based document, does a very good job on this. The level of detail or effort needed to do this varies in different stages, and which is why they call it a Rapid Bioassessment Protocol. But basically what you'll end up after sampling a stream or sediment is either with pollution-sensitive or pollution-tolerant organisms. And it doesn't take a PhD in entomology to see the difference between the level of fine detail and organization in the pollution-sensitive organisms versus the pollution-tolerant ones. Over on the left-hand side, EPT stands for Ephemeroptera, Plecoptera, and Trichoptera down the bottom here. That is mayflies, stoneflies, and caddisflies. So that's what we have over on the left. These are very sensitive organisms. Over on the right, we have, in the upper left-hand corner, we have black flies, we have nematodes, lower left we have leeches, and lower right we have sludge worms. So you can see that once you sample a site, you can rank the different organisms after that they're identified by pollution sensitivity, and then compare sites and determine sort of indirectly whether you've got some type of bioavailability going on. Usually, like in the lower left-hand photo, if I see a stonefly, I know that that site, automatically that site is going to be fairly clean because they're very sensitive organisms. On to slide number 42. This is what it looks like out in the field after sampling. These organisms have been sorted by class. So you see your mayflies, your stoneflies, and your caddisflies, and this is a clean stream here. Dragonflies or damselflies, a few beetles, and midges. Now you compare that to a more stream that is more disturbed with pollutants over in slide number 43. And this is adjacent to a shopping mall where you get a lot of runoff, you get changes in temperature, oils and greases, metals. And you can see that these are pollution-tolerant organisms that were sampled. Snails, phyca, scuds, some pollution-tolerant caddisflies and beetles and leeches. And so basically what I'm trying to show you here is you can go out and sample different areas of a stream and compare them by judging their abundance, the diversity, certain macroinvertebrate indices, and of course pollution tolerance and sensitivity. On to slide number 44, tools to assess the benthic pathway, we have predictive models. Some of you may be familiar with equilibrium partitioning. Basically, what this does is it sets the pore water concentration equal to the ambient water quality criteria, National Ambient Water Quality Criteria, and then back calculates a concentration based on the organic carbon content of the sediment, and it'll give you a bulk concentration that is essentially safe, which would be maybe your PRG based on equilibrium partitioning. The narcosis model is also similar to that. You can read that in the document. I've discussed SCM and ABS. And then there's the biotic ligand model. This is a fairly user-friendly model. It's very data-intensive, but it's fairly user-friendly in determining what might be the bioavailable fraction, mainly in surface or pore water. This model is so accurate that it's currently used to set the ambient water quality criteria for copper, the national values. And that you can read up on more of that both in the web document and on EPA links in the web document. So the biotic ligand model requires things like pH, temperature, competing cations like potassium, sulfate, magnesium, hardness, and of course DOC. So, again, it's data-intensive, but it's fairly user-friendly as far as running the model. Slide number 45, this is a case study example, the Tectonics Wetlands in Beaverton, Oregon. This is a historic operation where they had sediment metals that exceeded the Oregon DEQ screen level values. So that kicked off some more intensive investigations where they assessed the chemistry, toxicity, SCM, ABS, and TOC. So basically, they're doing a sediment quality triad with everything. Probably, let's see, they had a maximum SCM, ABS, FOC was 10 less than the EPA's adverse effect level. So because it's less than the adverse effect level, you would assume no effects. Well, that's what they saw in the toxicity testing. They saw no mortality and no adverse effects on growth for amphipods or midges, and they concluded that the concentrations didn't pose potential risks to the benthic community, So it was a no further action for this stretch of the creek based on chemistry toxicity and ABS SEM. Slide number 46. I guess we're at the end of this first section, and we'll take any questions for from the audience at this time.
Thanks, Steve. For our phone line audience, you can ask questions out loud if you'd like to. You do need to unmute your phone. So at your location, select unmute, and in our system, you need to select #6 to unmute the line, because we started out with all lines muted. And when you ask a question, please state your name, your organization, and the location you're calling in from. For the simulcast audience, it's that orange question mark at the top of the slide that allows you to send in questions. Anyone is welcome to use the question mark as well to send in a question. I do want to mention now, when I introduced Tamara Sorrell, I said the wrong company name. She's with Geosyntech Consultants. So if you are interested in learning more about her, on that main training page, she's listed as a trainer, and you can read her bio and see a picture. Do we have any questions to start from the phone line audience? We have a simulcast question from Bill Graves at INSAT in Noakesville, Virginia. Is this topic considered appropriate for lowlands that are not perennially wet, groundwater plus or minus 5 feet below ground surface, and typically in floodplains, or just actual location where water is normally present?
I would say, well, that's a tough question. I would say if the area has been delineated as a wetland, yes. Even though there are bioassays out there where you can select the right organism, even if it's an earthworm, and come up with some type of a number. But I think, I don't know the specifics, and maybe he could take it offline with me, but, if the area has been delineated as a jurisdictional wetland, I would still consider looking at bioavailability depending on, the constituent of concern. And I would also add to the audience, which I didn't mention earlier, most compounds are considered 100% bioavailable. There are instances where, like the IEUBK model, which is a lead model, there are instances where the model has already built in a bioavailability factor of like 50%. So when you are looking at a model or a specific compound, you need to look at the cost benefit. Is it worth my while in going from 50% to 40%, that type of thing? So that's just another caveat. But if he has other questions about that particular wetland, I'd be happy to field it offline.
From Alex Francisco at Arcadis in Walnut Creek, California, how are you addressing potential release of divalent metals into bioavailable form when sediments are processed and oxidized in laboratory toxicity tests?
That is a question I get a lot. And in the old days with SEM-ABS, they'd go out on the boat and they would have glove boxes and go to great lengths to try to keep the sediment from coming into contact with oxygen. I have found that that is not necessary anymore. As long as you keep just a thin film of water over the sediment, you're not going to get oxidation of the sediment. And even if oxygen were to come into contact with it, as long as you have enough sulfide, you need to go into the metals mixture document and look at what the solubility constants are for some of these metals. I mean, they are like 10 to the 22nd power. So even if oxygen comes into contact, especially for compounds like lead and zinc and copper especially, they will not dissociate once the sulfide has formed.
Thank you. For our phone line audience, do we have any questions? And remember #6 to unmute in our system. Let's go ahead and then and wrap up our question and answer break now. If you didn't get a chance to ask your question, we do hope to have time at the end of the training class for additional questions. If you have taken your phone off of mute, reminder, it's *6 to put it back on mute. We're going to continue on now with the second half of our training. And on slide 47, I'm going to turn this back to Steve Clow from Haley and Aldrich. Steve?
Thank you, Juliana. Slide 47, we get into Chapter 5, which is the fish and water column invertebrates pathway. These are the pelagic organisms that are reside above the sediment. Again, the team has divided this into three genres, the chemical testing, sediment, forewater, groundwater, surface water, in some cases tissue residues, biological tests, toxicity tests, and community surveys, as I mentioned earlier, the macroinvertebrate population surveys or fish surveys. And then predictive methods, which address accumulation factors and food webs and the biotic ligand model, as I've mentioned earlier. Again, this is fed into your risk management paradigm, and I think risk management, I believe, was Chapter 9. And so moving forward onto slide number 48, some of the tools to assess the fish and water column pathway. Obviously, the first thing you want to do is compare to national recommended water quality criteria. And, of course, the state water quality standards, which I have not seen a state that does not have them yet, so a lot of them have adopted EPAs. And so that's the first thing you want to do. That's the low-hanging fruit. Then you want to measure the water contaminants or measure the tissue residues that might have accumulated some of these contaminants. And if you don't have that, you know, like with a site-specific measurement, there are bioaccumulation factors out there in the literature. I'm going to mention a little bit later EPISuite, which is an EPA program in which you can get bioconcentration factors and bioaccumulation factors. There's the critical body burdens, and that is there's Army Corps of Engineer documentation out there, and this is in our web-based document. And then there's EPA information out there, which basically shows that 2.5 to 4 micromoles per kilogram body weight or micromoles per gram wet weight or millimoles per kilogram wet weight, and then 50 micromoles per gram of lipid for organics. Once you rise above that level, you'll start to see toxicity. Similar to a breathalyzer, if your blood rises to a certain level, you start to see, euphoria, drunkenness, and all that fun stuff. But that's your critical body burden. And then I'm going to discuss a little bit on the wildlife side, but you have toxicity reference values for some of these organisms that that reside in the water. Then we measure biota sediment accumulation factors, and this is simply the ratio of the in the numerator you have the concentration in the tissue divided by the fraction lipid, and in the denominator the concentration in sediment divided by the fraction organic carbon. So organic carbon and lipid really are equivalent in tissue and sediment respectively. Those are the media that bind hydrophobic compounds. And this will give you a biota sediment accumulation factor. And if it's less than 1 or less than 1.3, I think is the ideal. Usually you don't have too much to worry about, but if you are much greater than 1, or greater than the value cited in the literature for, say, a certain arachlor, then might want to look a little bit more closer at doing some more site-specific work. Slide number 49, you can conduct sediment toxicity tests using the appropriate organisms and conditions. Well, how do you do this with a species that live in the water column? Well, you can simply have a small 10-liter aquarium or lower, and you put your sediment in, you let it equilibrate, and then you add something like fathead minnows or daphnia, and that would tell you whether you might have toxicity in the overlying water. You can actually measure COPEX in organisms from field collected samples such as macroinvertebrates or fish, because fish will not bioaccumulate things like copper or zinc, obviously, because those are physiologically required in their diet, and they're regulated through the intestinal wall. But you can, you know, something like cadmium or PCBs, you can figure out bioavailability by what's in the water column versus what's in the organism. And then you can conduct population surveys and compare these to the reference areas, which are an ecological biome in your area that is similar to what the conditions that you have at your site. Slide number 50. Again, I mentioned accumulation factors. The US EPA EpiSuite program, that's one of my Bibles. This can be easily downloaded. It's literally a two-click model in which you enter the compound name. It'll even look the compound up for you. And once you get the name, you just click calculate, and it will come up literally with about 15 different partitioning coefficients. Very powerful tool. It'll even tell you whether the substance is, whether there's a good probability that the substance might biodegrade if it's an organic. Bioaccumulation factors are in the public domain. I'm sure many of you have searched for them and figured out what's a reasonable range for something like lead or PCBs. There's a lot of this in the peer-reviewed literature. And then I just mentioned biosediment accumulation factors and for fish or organisms or even shellfish that they're siphon feeders that aren't directly exposed to the sediment but mainly exposed to surface water. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineer, or ORD, has a BSAF database. These are easily searchable. And then biomagnification factors are out there for some compounds, although this is a little bit more esoteric, but use biomagnification factors when you get into trophic level modeling. Biotic ligand model I mentioned for metals is very useful for the water column. And then food web modeling I'll discuss that in a little bit here. Slide number 51 is a case study where they use the fish and water column invertebrates pathway. This is the McCormick and Baxter Superfund site in Oregon. They had creosote-derived contaminants, including pHs and dioxins. They looked at sediment chemistry, bioassays, tissue residues in fish and crayfish, and fish histopathology, which is fairly rare, but it's a very good diagnostic technique. The results, the sediment chemistry, and the toxicity testing indicated that there were areas of the Willamette River that were likely to be toxic, although the residues for pHs were low in crayfish, large-scale sucker, and the examination of all of the histopathology slides showed no statistical differences between the site and upstream locations. Now, despite that, you have a risk management decision where professional judgment comes into play, and since they probably still had residuals even after placement of an impermeable cap, they required long-term monitoring. So that's a very good example of how bioavailability tools could be used for the fish and water column invertebrates pathway. Slide number 52 is the wildlife pathway. And as I mentioned in the beginning, wildlife can be mallard ducks, sandpipers, herons, egrets, muskrats, mink. This, again, we divided into three genres: chemical testing, which is tissue residues. And be careful there, because tissue residues, even when you get a concentration, sometimes it's difficult to tell what level might might be an impact. Biological tests, community surveys, and toxicity tests. And then empirical wildlife models, and there's a number of them out there, some with a steep learning curve and some not, but the standard food chain model might be something like a simple spreadsheet model that you derive using US EPA's Exposure Factors Handbook, the estimation of BSAFs, and then there are process-based predictive models such as GOBIS, BASS, and WASP. These are EPA legacy models that were in the works for decades in some cases. And so if you're going to attempt to hurdle those, you need to be aware of their the complexity and their limitations and what the assumptions in the model are. Slide number 53. Well, most wildlife are exposed just through ingestion of sediment. I mean, they will get it through their food, of course, but the majority of their risk comes from the inadvertent ingestion of sediment. And some over on the left-hand side, we have a mallard, which is a dabbling duck, which will ingest sediment. And on the right-hand, we have a sandpiper. Some of these birds will ingest up to 18% of their diet weight will be sediment. So a good way to screen wildlife is you already know that you have a bulk sediment concentration. You have a literature bioaccumulation factor, or you can set it to 1, and you know what the percent of the diet is. So you calculate the dose, and down in the lower right-hand corner, the dose is the percent of the sediment in the diet. So it's the concentration of the sediment times the percent diet, and that gives you a dose in milligrams per kilogram per day. You compare that to your threshold, that should be toxicity reference value. And if it passes, then you don't have no further action at the site because you've just run a very conservative screening test. If it doesn't pass, you move into screening level ecological risk assessment or your baseline ecological risk assessment. So basically, what you're measuring here is not necessarily bioavailability, but bioaccessibility in the sediment. And speaking of bioaccessibility, which is slide number 54, this is an in vitro test in which simulates the stomach acid or the stomach contents of a bird, and this can also be done for a mammal. These tests usually run about $200 a piece. And basically what it's doing is, you know, you've got amino acids in here, you've got a very acidic environment, like a pH of around 3, and the sediment is incubated and stirred for about an hour, I believe, and then they filter it. So what goes through the filter will be, assumingly, it's going to be what's going to be absorbed by the organism. This is called an in vitro gastrointestinal simulation test. You can see over on the right from this journal article that they were able to correlate the physiological-based extraction test of lead in the gizzard of this animal, if they were to eat the sediment, with the blood lead that actually might be or predicted in a duck or, say, a robin that eats earthworms or something like that. On to slide number 55, this is getting more into terrestrial wildlife in some sense, but mainly to semi-aquatic organisms. You can do tissue residue analysis, and as I mentioned earlier, you really need to have clear endpoints before you do this. What level of, say, dioxin in bird eggs might be an adverse effect? I mean, that's one example where I know there's a certain level of dioxins that are allowed in the egg of a bird. Or mercury, I think they use loons and mercury to figure out what might be cause an adverse effect in the offspring. Toxicity testing is expensive, but it is site-specific. The lower left-hand photograph shows a Japanese quail, and these are being fed a seed that is mixed with the sediment that might be at the site. Not sure about what other types of laboratory animals they can use, but again, there are vendors out there that will do toxicity testing with sediments. Food web modeling can, again, I said, it can be as simple as a spreadsheet, or it can be a very, very complex model. And I think, I believe these are gone over in the bioaccumulation document. And then population surveys, you need to be careful here because you need to consider the scale of the site. For example, if the home range of the receptor of interest is, say, 150 acres, but your site is only an acre large, well, then you know you don't have to worry about doing a population survey because the dilution would just be too great as far as the feeding, what that animal feeds on. And the lower right-hand graphic basically shows you how mercury can be, as it moves its way up the food chain, it can multiply the trophic magnification factors are quite high for an aquatic system. Slide number 56 is the plant's pathway. I'm only going to touch on this a little because it's rarely used, although the timing's good because I just worked on a site submitted a proposal for a site in California that's a refinery site, and there's very, very, very high levels of carbon black in the sediments. And so what we're concerned about actually is no bioavailability of the nutrients. And, you know, if we plant something there, is it going to grow? So on to slide number, again, we've divided this into three genres: toxicity tests, bioaccumulation modeling, and tissue tests. And on slide number 57, the plant pathway, again, like the site that I'm working on in California or that we're putting a proposal out for, we're proposing that we send the sediments to the lab and we actually add seeds or seedlings and see if the seeds will actually germinate, and if they do germinate, what will be the root length and what will be the survivability and things like that. And then bioaccumulation, there are sites that have been worked on where you go and you snip off leaves or fruits of various plants that are in your disposal area and then plants that are outside the disposal area, and you compare them statistically. And finally, plant toxicity is usually, well, in the state of Massachusetts, one of the first things you look for is absence of vegetation. That's a sign that there's usually some type of an egregious hazardous concentration of a compound in the soil. But there are compounds out there like boron, where if you have an excessive concentration in the soil, you'll get chlorosis of the leaves, yellowing of the leaves, and you can actually see toxicity at the site. And I believe the documentation, the bioavailability web-based document discusses wild rice, although that's more in terms of human exposure. And that, I believe, does it. Let's see. Yeah, we're now on to the human health pathway, where Tamara Sorrell, as Juliana indicated earlier, she is a very bright risk assessor with GeoSyntech, and she is going to describe the human health bioavailability as it relates to human health. So, Tamara, take it away.
Can you guys hear me?
We can, yes.
Okay, I'm never quite sure. Okay, we're on slide 58, and as you can see here, it's the same general model that we've used throughout this document to organize and describe the different pathways. And the typical concerns with humans are direct contact, and it was just pointed out earlier, sediment ingestion is important for humans as well as for wildlife, and then, of course, food ingestion, which is anything dietary, and that can be particularly important for native populations that rely on a lot of hunted or fished food. If you look on slide 59, it provides a little more detail about the human health exposure pathways, and I should point out that, you know, direct contact is not just dermal absorption on the skin when you're talking about humans, but also includes that incidental ingestion component where you're inadvertently swallowing some portion of sediment either through a recreational activity or through your food. And then, of course, there are the dietary pathways, and those relate back to the other evaluations that have been described previously for the different types of foodstuffs, fish, wildlife, and plants. Normally, we don't worry too much about bioaccumulation if you don't have what we call a persistent and bioaccumulative and toxic constituent, and that's typically, you know, pesticides, PCBs, dioxins, and mercury. But there are some jurisdictions, some states, Texas, for example, and the Pacific Northwest, that establish other constituents as potentially bioaccumulative as well. So that may need to be looked at. Slide 60 describes a little more of the direct contact. And bioavailability in humans really is twofold concerns. You know, one is, as we've described, is the constituent getting into the food chain, into the ecosystem where it might be available for accumulation and up on somebody's plate. And then, of course, once a human is exposed to something, what is the actual absorption out of that foodstuff? And that secondary issue is a little more difficult to evaluate. You know, Steve mentioned that there are in vitro tests, as he knows, for lead and also for arsenic, starting to be available to look at whether something's really bioavailable, for example, in the gut. Swine are often used. Those are very expensive, especially if they're in vivo. So normally we use some kind of default assumption about gastrointestinal absorption. The other thing we can look at is how much sediment actually sticks to the skin. And those kinds of variables can be modified by looking at your scenario and trying to figure out what people actually do. Do you have, you know, like one of the questioners earlier asked about wetland soils. Do you have some place that's really not saturated where you can get a lot of mud on your skin and it might not get washed off right away? Or are you talking about a sandy bottom on the edge of a lake where you would not expect any adherence? And so those are good variables to modify to reflect realistic bioavailability. Slide 61 goes a little more into the fish and shellfish, and this, in my experience, is the most likely human health pathway to drive a remediation at sediment sites. And again, it comes down to the issue of what is getting into the fish, and then from the fish, what's getting absorbed by humans. And, you know, in most cases, that gastrointestinal absorption will be pretty close to 100%, especially when you're talking about lipophilic organics such as PCBs. To evaluate what is actually in fish tissue coming from the site, it goes back to a lot of what we've talked about in the previous sections where and tissue modeling and tissue measurement. And again, as was pointed out, tissue measurement, it can be tricky to correlate specifically what you see in tissue with any specific source. So that has its drawbacks, but often is really the only thing that we can look at that actually reflects real exposure. Slide 52 refers to an example that we have in our document, and I encourage you to go back and look at that. It's just an example of how you can do something very simple with site-specific data to try to screen out constituents of concern. And this was an example for hexachlorobenzene, and which, of course, is inorganic and is assumed to bind to carbon. And the default screening level uses, you know, conservative assumptions for fish lipid and sediment organic carbon content. And if you know for a fact that you have a different kind of fish there and that you have a higher organic carbon that you've measured in your sediment, you can easily put those into a simple algorithm and modify that. It's all proportional. And in this case, we show that you could raise your screening level 15-fold. And that can help you a lot in introducing efficiency into your risk assessment because you can start to eliminate things that are not of concern and can even help you tailor your field program. So, you know, I would encourage you always to look and see whether there is an appropriate and conservative way to screen something out using simple bioavailability-based tools. Slide 63 addresses a little bit more unusual pathways of wildlife and plant exposure. These are not typically the drivers at most of the, you know, complex urbanized sediment sites that most of us deal with, but they can be a concern where you're dealing with more rural or indigenous populations, and if you have people who hunt, people eating waterfowl or you know, not so much deer, but there may be other semi-aquatic animals, or if they're consuming plant stuffs that, you know, tend to be grown in contaminated sediment areas that are, you know, water-loving, that there is a potential for that uptake. And these pathways have been addressed in the previous section. So that pretty much concludes the human health section. It's a relatively small section of our document because it draws very heavily on content presented previously. So you know, you can take advantage of the web-based modality to navigate through the document and back to from this section to other sections of concern. Thank you.
Thank you, Tamara. We're going to move on now to slide 65, and I'm going to turn the presentation over to Greg Newman of the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. Greg?
Okay, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thanks.
Okay. Good afternoon, everybody. Now that you have a rather good understanding of how bioavailability can be used to assess risk from the exposure to contaminated sediments, we'd like to share with you a case study that illustrates the application of a few of the measurement tools described earlier in today's discussion. For the purpose of this training, we've selected the Indiana Steel and Wire site. So please move forward to slide 66. Okay, first a little background on the site. The Indiana Steel and Wire site was a galvanizing plant located in Muncie, Indiana. Manufacturing operations began in the early 60s and consisted of the production of steel wire products. From 1962 through 1972, plant wastewater and treatment sludge was discharged to a 2.8-acre limestone quarry called Mox Pond. As part of the wastewater treatment process, lime was added to the influent pipeline to neutralize the wastewater before discharging to the pond. As a result of its past use, Mox Pond contained an estimated 51,000 cubic yards of sediment. The material was primarily lime-stabilized spent sludge that was comprised of iron and other metal hydroxides, calcium sulfate, as well as calcium carbonate. The specific contaminants of concern associated with the sediment included antimony, arsenic, cadmium, chromium, copper, lead, and zinc, as well as cyanide. Okay, slide 67. All right, this slide really just goes over some of the site characterization efforts. The initial site characterization studies involved the evaluation of sediment, surface water, as well as an assessment of biological health. The sediment medium was analyzed through bulk sediment chemistry analyses for priority pollutant metals and cyanide, sediment toxicity tests, leachability studies, and waste classification sampling was also conducted. Surface water was evaluated with the collection of surface water samples, also analyzed for priority pollutant metals as well as cyanide. And the biological assessment was really geared towards identifying the types of ecological receptors associated with the pond habitat. This was accomplished with a water column assessment to identify plankton type, as well as macroinvertebrate, fish, and wildlife surveys. Additionally, to determine if the metal contamination was bioavailable, fish tissue samples were collected and also analyzed for prior pollutant metals as well as cyanide. Okay, on to slide 68. All right, so as you can see, the results of the site characterization studies indicated that the physical nature of the sediment sludge mixture was not very conductive to supporting a benthic community. The sediment consisted of a very fine grain material and was absent of organic matter. And as noted earlier, it was visually evident that lime was added to the waste stream prior to discharging to the pond. And it was hypothesized that this step may have altered the bioavailability of the metals through the formation of insoluble metal hydroxides. The surface water results were actually in compliance with the water quality standards. However, as illustrated in the table here, the sediment chemistry results were found to grossly exceed their respective sediment screening criteria, with chromium, copper, and lead found at elevated concentrations much higher than their sediment screening criteria. Waste classification and leachability testing indicated that the metals were tightly bound and all the leachate results were classified as non-hazardous. All right, slide 69. All right, the biological assessment revealed the presence of both phytoplankton and zooplankton in the water column, as well as a healthy population of pelagic fish. Benthic fish, or fish associated with the pond bottom, those types of species would be catfish and suckers, as well as macroinvertebrates, were not present. The presence of plankton and fish in the water column provided some preliminary evidence that the metals within the sediment may not actually be bioavailable to water column receptors. Slide 70. Okay, so based on the initial investigations of the pond, it was assumed that the impacted sediment in the pond was biologically unavailable to upper trophic level organisms and not impacting the overlying surface water. In consideration of future use, it was presumed that the pond could potentially support recreational fishing. To justify this assumption, the Indiana Department of Environmental Management required that a human health and ecological risk assessment be conducted. The human health risk assessment involved the screening of sediment data and fish tissue concentrations to appropriate screening values. In this case, the sediment results were compared to Indiana's Tier 2 residential cleanup goals and the fish tissue concentrations to EPA Region 3 residential RBCs. The results of the risk assessment revealed that antimony, chromium, lead, and zinc were retained as COCs in sediment, while arsenic was identified as a contaminant of concern in fish. The receptors and pathways evaluated in the human health risk assessment were the ones that you're probably familiar with in terms of exposure routes, the incidental ingestion, direct contact, and ingestion of fish were evaluated. And for this site, the receptors of concern the receptors that were considered were the future construction worker, a park worker, as well as recreational visitors and recreational anglers. Slide 71. Okay, the human risk assessment also involved exposure modeling, determine risk to future receptors. Specifically, exposure modeling was conducted for the construction worker and the recreational angler. Lead was modeled using the US EPA IEUBK model, while the remaining prior pollutant metals were evaluated using an intake model. The results of the modeling indicated an unacceptable risk to the construction worker for lead based on direct contact and recreational angler for arsenic based on fish consumption. Okay, next slide, slide 72. Okay, on the ecological side, ecological risk was evaluated during the screening stage by comparing bulk sediment chemistry results to several sets of sediment screening criterion. The criteria utilized consisted of the Great Lakes ARC's threshold effect levels, the Ontario lowest effect levels, and the Washington State lowest apparent effects threshold levels. As far as fish tissue goes, the fish tissue concentrations from Mox Pond were compared to fish tissue concentrations from fish collected from a background area. And for this comparison, the White River, which is actually adjacent to the site, was selected to serve as that background area. Okay, on to slide 73. All right, as you can see, most of the metals in the sediment were detected at concentrations above their respective screening levels and were retained as contaminants of potential environmental concern. The comparison of Mox Pond fish tissue concentrations to those of fish from the White River revealed that concentrations were actually below background. Based on the sediment screening results, an additional assessment of risk was warranted for sediment and associated receptors. Specifically, dietary exposure modeling was conducted to evaluate risk to both fish eating birds as well as mammals. The overall results of the risk assessment concluded that there is the potential for risk to benthic organisms, benthic fish, and submerged and emergent plants from exposure to contaminated sediments. The lines of evidence that support this conclusion were the levels of metals measured in the sediment, as well as the absence of benthic receptors from the pond. The absence of these species suggested that a remedial action would be required to restore the pond bottom as a component of a healthy aquatic ecosystem. The risk did appear to be confined to bottom-dwelling organisms, as a healthy pelagic community was found to exist with little evidence of metals and fish tissue that could be transferred to piscivorous birds or mammals actually utilizing the pond. On to slide 74. Okay, so again, in evaluating the results of both the human health and ecological risk assessments, it was concluded that remediation of the pond sediments was needed to provide protection to both human health, to both humans and the ecological receptors that may utilize the pond. The remedial action selected included the removal of sediment as needed to provide a water depth of 10 feet, followed by the installation of a geotextile liner and placement of a sand cap atop the residual sediments. The remedial action plan required two phases of post-remediation monitoring. Phase one post-construction monitoring of the subaqueous cap was conducted at 6 months and 1 year after cap placement, and this monitoring basically assessed the physical integrity of the cap through sediment coring and bathymetry investigations. Phase two consisted of annual monitoring that went on for a period of 5 years after the cap was put in place. Slide 75. Okay, so again, the annual monitoring was really designed to determine the effectiveness of the cap at chemically isolating the sediment contamination. And this was evaluated through the collection of pore water, surface water, as well as sediment samples. The bioavailability of the metals in sediment was evaluated through the collection of sediment pore water samples. In this instance, in-situ pore water samples were collected via large volume peepers. As you can see from the photo here in the slide, the peepers consisted of dialysis tubing that were filled with reagent-grade water that were then placed into a protective sheet. These devices were then inserted into the pond sediment to a depth of 10 centimeters and were left in place for 10 days to allow them to equilibrate with the surrounding interstitial pore water. After 10 days, these samples were retrieved and were analyzed. So as discussed earlier in this presentation, pore water concentrations provide a much more accurate measure of bioavailability as compared to simple bulk chemistry sediment data. The pore water data, when combined with sediment and surface water data, provide a multiple lines of evidence approach to assessing risk to the benthic community. Okay, slide 76. Okay, this slide summarizes the results of the post-construction monitoring as well as the five-year annual monitoring. On the post-construction monitoring, the physical state of the cap was again evaluated at the six-month and one-year interval after cap installation, and it was determined that the cap was stable and uniformly covering the pond bottom. Results of the five-year post-remedial monitoring confirmed that the metals were tightly sequestered and not biologically available, as sediment, surface water, and pore water results were all below their respective screening criteria or background concentrations. Slide 77. All right, this last slide concludes the Moccasin Pond case study. As you can see from the table, especially the last column on the right, the year 5 post-remedial sediment data shows that the remedial action implemented was effective. All metal concentrations in the sediment are well below their respective screening values. As stated previously, the pore water and surface water results at year 5 are also below the respective standards or background. And this case study, again, just highlights how bioavailability was assessed during the risk assessment and through the use of sediment toxicity tests and fish tissue sampling, and in the post-remedial monitoring phase via pore water sampling. Okay, slide 78, please. All right, this slide concludes our training on how bioavailability can be incorporated into the evaluation of contaminated sediments. In the past, sediment remedial actions were often based on conservative literature-based screening values that did not take into account the concept of bioavailability. We hope that this training has left you with a better understanding of bioavailability and some of the innovative tools and measures that can be used to more accurately define contaminant exposure concentrations or that fraction of the contaminant that is truly available for receptor uptake. The incorporation of bioavailability in both the risk assessment and risk management process can result in the generation of technically sound, site-specific remedial goals that are protective of the environment. In closing, I'd like to let you know that the contaminated sediment team is currently in the process of developing a follow-up document to this one that addresses sediment remediation, so keep an eye out for that. And at this point, I'm going to turn the discussion back over to our moderator, Juliana Cheatham. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Greg. On slide 79, we are going to have time for some questions, so in our simulcast audience, you're welcome to start sending in those questions using the orange question mark button. Before we take questions, I do want to take you to our links page and our feedback form. You're welcome to select either area of the slide. If you go to the links page, you can look to the left under the Clue in Sun. The third button down takes you over to the feedback. We do look for everyone on the call today to fill out the feedback form. We really do use that information. I appreciate you taking a few minutes to give us your feedback. Looking at the links page, we list some recommended prerequisites. You may not have been able to get to these before the class, but these are available now for you if you're interested in reading more. In Section 2, Download Today's ITRC Training, this link's going to allow you to download the presentation that you've seen during today's training class. In addition to what you've seen on the slides, there's more information in the notes section of the downloaded version. Today's training introduced the ITRC web-based technical and regulatory guidance incorporating bioavailability considerations into the evaluation of contaminated sediment sites, the CS-1. Following this link, it's going to take you over to the ITRC website where you can view this online guidance. We also have additional links to ITRC documents. Some of these we've mentioned in the training today. There's much more information available on the ITRC website, so I encourage you to go to the website and review. And we've also included a few additional links on our links page as well. We now want to take time for questions from our audience.
for the simulcast audience, it's back on the slides, the orange question mark that allows you to send in questions. For our phone line audience, you're welcome to ask questions out loud. You need to unmute your phone at your location and also select #6 to unmute in our system. That's #6. And when you ask a question, please state your name, your organization, and the location that you're calling in from. Do you have any questions to start from our phone line audience? We have a question from our simulcast audience, and this is from Carol at University of Minnesota in Duluth. Who is the speaker or presenter who's discussed plant pathways? And I will start by answering this. On slide 6, you can see a list of all of our trainers, and Steve Crow is our presenter for that section. I'll also point out on the main training page, you can see a list of all of our trainers, and including Tamara Sorrell's email address if you're interested in contacting her. And you can read brief bios to learn more about our trainers. From Lori at U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services in Anchorage, Alaska, in your Indiana case study, did vimp-like organisms colonize the pond after the remediation?
Yeah, hi, this is Greg. Again, I'm from New Jersey, so I wasn't actively involved with this case. This case was selected as a case study that was actually used in our document. I don't believe that actual macroinvertebrate community surveys were conducted as a part of the post-remediation monitoring, but I'd be happy to try and look into the site information and see if I can answer that question for you. As far as I know, though, I think they just assessed the health of the benthic organism community by sediment pore water sampling and sediment toxicity testing. So I'm not really sure if they actually did community surveys.
From Alexander Zazinski at the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection, it would seem that at least some of the cases that you may be able to show that a given certain physical environment that bioavailability considerations would show that an area is not a significant risk to wildlife or humans for a given land use. However, if the land use of the area or use of the water area changes in the future in a way that might change the physical characteristics of the local environment, for instance, you get increased turbation of sediment, could you move into a new situation where bioavailability considerations would change such that the sediment for the new land use now poses a risk? Have legal tools such as land use restrictions ever been combined with the use of bioavailability considerations to ensure an area does not pose a risk in the future?
That's a tough question. I personally, this is Steve Powell, I don't know of too many sites where the physical or chemical or biological processes might change so much that you're going to change the underlying bioavailability processes. I know here in Massachusetts we have activity and use limitations, and I would suppose that, I'm not a legal, but I would think that you could probably write into that AUL that care must be taken in the future as far as, you know, maybe fishing or some type of recreation. But that's kind of a sticky wicket. I'm not sure I can answer that fully.
Thank you. Do you have any questions from our phone line audience? I do want to wait just a little bit longer. We have about 5 more minutes on the call to see if any additional simulcast questions come in. Do our trainers want to tell us a little bit more about the new ITRC project that you're working on?
Sure, Juliana. This is John Cargill. I can talk a little bit about that. We're in 2 years into a 3-year process of creating a remedy selection framework guidance document. Right now we've got a pretty decent draft together. We're working on refining some what we're calling rules of thumb that will help practitioners and regulators kind of get through the nitty-gritty of parameters that go into selecting an appropriate remedy for a contaminated sediment site. It's going to be another web-based guidance, more highly functional, I think, than this current bioavailability guidance is, but a good companion document to this bioavailability document as well. It's scheduled for release, I believe it's March of 2014, in that time frame, beginning of 2014. We'll have this next document polished up and ready to send out to the public. So please keep your eyes open. It's going to be a great tool to go along with this bioavailability document for assessing and actually remediating contaminated sediment sites.
Thanks, John.
Sure.
For our phone line audience, remember #6 to unmute your phone. We did start out with all lines muted, in addition to unmuting at your location. Do you have any questions from the phone line audience? It looks like we are out of questions then for today's class, and we'll go ahead and wrap up. I'd like to thank our trainers and our participants for joining us today. If you have not already, please fill out that feedback form. We really do use that information. More information on ITRC is available on the website, www.itrcweb.org. Thanks again for joining us, and have a great day.